6, starting with some breaking news, and shots have been fired at a shopping centre in Munich, according to German police. There's no word yet on casualties. A wide area around the building's been cordoned off. Officers say a large operation is underway. Some experts are warning the UK is facing a recession driven by the decision to leave the European Union. A survey of business leaders shows reports of fewer new orders and increased cancellations. It suggests the economy's slumped at its fastest rate since the financial crisis. Chairman of HSBC Douglas Flint is with the Chancellor on a trade trip to China. He says the exit isn't affecting the message they're trying to get across.
Nothing really needs to change. We're still collaborating, cooperated, committed to the relationship in this golden era, and we can see huge opportunity for taking it further on both sides.
The hunt for the missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 will be suspended if the plane isn't found in the current search area. Authorities have scoured more than 100,000 square kilometres for the aircraft, which disappeared with 239 people on board in 2014. Malaysian Transport Minister Liao Tiong Lai says they found no credible new evidence but will restart the operation if some emerges.
I must emphasise that these does not mean that we have given up on locating MH370.
Russia is facing a possible suspension from the Paralympics. The IPC, which runs the event, has opened disciplinary proceedings in the wake of the drug scandal which engulfed the Winter Olympics. That's the latest.
If you're looking for work,
BCFM 93.2 is a charity run entirely by volunteers. That means we are not for profit, so we can put you, the people of Bristol, first. BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
You can count on.
We're all manipulated. We're all misled. It is difficult at best to even come close to the truth. But that's what we're going to try to do on this show, and we are going to be bombarding you with information from every source from here on out.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Scores of Russian athletes who'd never tested positive for doping be banned from the Rio Olympics? Is somebody preparing for world war? This didn't even happen in the 1936 Berlin Olympics in the run-up to World War II. So what's happening when geopolitics takes over sport? Also, Friday night's coup attempt in Turkey, when it was real or orchestrated, President Erdogan brings a new era of popular dictatorship into NATO and into the Middle East. And it's the end of the school year. But as the US philosopher John Dewey said, education is a system of imposed ignorance. The teaching of how the world really works goes on at places like Rhodes College in Oxford, where dim-witted crooks such as former US President Bill Clinton are paid for by a Rhodes Scholar grant, then fast-tracked into what you need to know over just 3 or 4 years to be a president or a prime minister. So for the summer holidays, we pull away the curtain of educational deception and encourage you to get beneath the surface of history. We'll have a look at the idea that the people that run the world aren't really the elected politicians, but the people who own our world and its media, banking and secret services, the elite institutions. We look at the five big crime families whose ownership and control of the institutions of power has effectively turned the Western world into a silent dictatorship where the needs of ordinary people like you and I don't even register. And we ask, does the wealth and power of some of these families go back hundreds of years? But first, Martin, this doping scandal really has been treated almost as a sports story with no links to geopolitics. Almost all of the coverage I've heard is where various athletes saying, well, something had to break at some point. It's just a shame it's the Russians. Now, one of the things I circulated on Twitter a couple of days ago was pictures of a US tennis player who's obviously been taking steroids, and a picture of Sharapova, the Russian one, who hadn't. Now, it looks to me as if the Americans are the ones who are doing the doping, not the Russians at all.
Well, I mean, allegations of this sort need to be investigated independently. What is very strange is that a whole country has been barred, rather than individual sports people who've misbehaved. That does suggest that some politics are involved. And don't forget that there's also pretty solid attempts to try and prevent the Russians having the World Cup next year, for the same reasons. And this is all part of a new Cold War with the Russians, which is totally unnecessary. But the elites that you were talking about are determined to have it.
Well, on our show page, I'm going to put this picture, which shows Serena Williams and Sharapova, whereas Serena Williams' arms, I mean, she's clearly on drugs of some sort.
That's an allegation, Tony.
Well,
it's not
it's just the appearance of the person. It looks as if there's steroids have gone in.
Well,
there.
Yes, but that's not really evidence, is it?
Well, it's photographic evidence.
Yes, okay, but I mean,
have a look here.
We know that dope, because of the amount of money involved in sport, including through things like betting, and the politics of winning are so important. Everybody is in. You know, this has been dogging all kinds of sport for a very long time. Singling out the Russians for particular treatment seems to me to be a clearly political move.
We've had in football too the removal of Sepp Blatter, so big changes in these big international sporting.
That's right, because there's a general war going on against Russia, in which all of the, and Sepp Blatter was a Swiss citizen, and of course there's an awful lot of corruption in sport, both in terms of who wins things like the Olympics and the World Cup, and which countries get to have, you know, like Qatar, which is, you know, has won the World Cup even though it's going to have to be played in ridiculous heat, a totally inappropriate place to have it, and so on and so forth. Sport, I'm afraid, is part of the general structure of society, and just like financial decisions, sporting decisions, military decisions, they're all linked in the world in which we live.
Let me just point out here, both FIFA and the IAAF have in their constitutions specific clauses which say that there cannot be any political motivation in what they do. Now, this seems to me to be some kind of clear political motivation, where you've got scores of athletes. We're talking about something like 60 or 70 athletes who've never, ever tested positive anywhere for doping, even though they've been tested by all sorts of different nationalities in many different countries. They're all being told you can't compete. Now, I wonder whether the Russians maybe should think about having a kind of parallel Olympics where they're having races at the same exact time and doing them on a split-screen TV just to show what their athletes can do.
This is
totally unfair to all these people who have never been doped at all. They're just being collective punishment because they're Russian.
Yes, it defies natural justice. And don't forget that the Olympics is happening in a country, Brazil, in which we've just had a soft coup against the elected government so that they can get rid of their social programs and get back to making money for the super oligarchy that runs Brazil. That's the real world we live in. It's tough, isn't it?
But are we being silly assuming that... Am I being silly assuming that there is some geopolitics behind this?
No, you're right. It clearly is. Geopolitical interference.
I mean, if you look at the IAAF, it's the federation of all of the amateur athletic associations all over the world. The president is Seb Coe, who was a Conservative MP.
Well, it's okay to have ex-political people involved in these things, but they're not supposed to make political decisions like banning a whole country and athletes who've never tested. If you're going to ban athletes because they tested positive for doping, that should be an individual athlete that is punished for their individual misbehaviour. A whole country and athletes who've never been convicted.
What they've called it is state-sponsored doping.
Well, that's just... Yeah, but they can say that, but I mean, the individuals who are being banned from the Rio Olympics are individuals who have never been convicted of doping. So that's nothing to do with them, even if the Russian state was involved in doping. And we know back in the communist era there was enormous amounts of doping went on. And of course the other thing that happened in the communist era is that they used to win all the football matches and everything because their people were all amateurs, because there was no professional sport in the Soviet Union, so their top sports people were all amateurs, so they cleaned up at the Olympics. Whereas in the West, of course, sport has become a multi-million pound zillion pound business in which ordinary people are bilked at every turn.
What do you think is appropriate to put SEBCO in charge of the IAAF if he has quite clearly got a political affiliation?
Well, no,
Britain is and the US are behind all these invasions in the Middle East, part of the NATO alliance. Is that appropriate to have someone who's a political figure running the IAAF?
Not inappropriate, provided they've got some link to sport, which he has. You know, he's not just a politician, he's a sportsman who happened to be a politician as well, and therefore possibly a legitimate person to run it. But of course, if Seb Coe is going on, as he probably is at the minute, that the Russians should be banned from the Olympics, then he's acting as a politician rather than as a sports leader, and I'm afraid that won't do. And if we're going to bring politics into it, then politics will be brought into it, and it will infect everything if that's what people want.
When
you get accused of it and you get banned from things as well.
The finger has been pointed at Russia after the middle of last year, last spring actually. There was a German documentary about Russian doping, but the producer of the documentary, the journalist involved, said, "Look, this is going on in many countries. I just had the opportunity to have a look at it in Russia."
Well, quite. We know it's going on. I mean, we know in particular that countries like the United States are the centre of international doping, because the amount of money involved in sport in the United States is enormous. It's fantastic. It's a multi-million pound business. Losing is unthinkable.
A whistleblower in April this year accused the British Anti-Doping Agency of catastrophic failure. An amateur cyclist, Dan Stevens, passed a UCAD information on someone called a Dr. Mark Bonar. UCAD says, that's UK Anti-Doping, says it's not been given names of anybody, any other alleged patients, right? So it's basically not doing any investigation. It's just going on what he's said. This is the whistleblower at the centre of the doping allegations against a London-based doctor has accused UK Anti-Doping of catastrophic failure. A report in the Sunday Times alleged Dr. Mark Bonar prescribed performance-enhancing drugs to 150 British athletes, including Premier League footballers, British Tour de France cyclists, tennis players and a boxer. The newspaper claimed UCAD was given information about the doctor's alleged doping activities 2 years ago but failed to take action, and an independent inquiry is to be held to look at the matter. An interview with BBC Sport, former amateur cyclist and drugs cheat Dan Stevens came forward as a whistleblower. 40-year-old Stevens was banned for 2 years when he refused to give an out-of-competition sample, a suspension which was reduced by 3 months. He said he found the Dr. Bonar online after being diagnosed with low testosterone levels and initially found him to be a sensible, good doctor, but Stevens claimed that Bonar would later talk to him about other drugs such as human growth hormone and EPO. He said, "I think it was quite revolutionary to meet a British doctor in a private clinic. He was telling me a number of high-profile British athletes, cyclists, runners, boxers, cricketers and footballers were all using these substances to improve their performance. And yet the UK Anti-Doping Agency did absolutely nothing about it."
Well, I'll make 2 points. Perhaps Britain should be banned from the Olympics on that basis. And can I make another point? Perhaps we ought to get over the idea that doping's bad. Maybe we should just say anybody can do anything in sport. We'll just try and dope people up to do whatever they can do and just level the playing field that way. Of course, it won't be very good for people's health, but we might get some more world records broken, eh?
It does seem as if, from the evidence from the guy that started it all, the German documentary maker, I'll put some links to that on our show page as well, and from this British whistleblower, that Russia definitely has been singled out here.
I think that's absolutely clear. And, given the tenseness in international relations and the possibility of mistakes leading to major war, it's not very fortunate that this further irritation has been added into our relations. But I think the Russians are very, very philosophical about all of this, actually. They're not going to take it personally. They're not going to get mad. They're just going to get even.
One way or another. Also, Martin, this time last Friday, I suppose it was just about the beginning to be in progress, it was the coup attempt over in Istanbul and Ankara, which has led to something like 6,000-7,000 arrests now. President Erdogan much more firmly in power now.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot about this week to try and work out
what's been going on. Breakdown on it all.
Well, the centre of the coup was clearly Inkilik Air Base, which is the NATO air base where the US is mostly... It's a Turkish air base, but it's a bit like RAF Fairford. It's not really controlled by the Turks.
It's a US air base, which is used for airstrikes. It's been there for decades, hasn't it?
It wasn't in the Middle East. It wasn't allowed to be used in the 1991 Gulf War or in the 2003 Gulf War because the Turkish government both times said, look, you can't use the air base for that. What the real political significance, whatever the actual detail of the coup, and there's still stuff coming out about this, is it shows a break between Turkey and the Western powers, particularly the US. The Turks last week basically apologised. Erdogan apologised to Putin for shooting down his plane in Syria, and now the guys that were actually shot the plane down have been arrested as part of the coup faction. Okay. So Erdogan's arrested those people, the pilots that are actually shot down. So he's basically saying, I didn't want that to happen, somebody made it happen, and now we're punishing those responsible. And he's going to be meeting with Putin very shortly. Now, it could well be, and that's where my money is, that this was an attempt by elements within the Turkish military, which are linked to the British and the Americans, to remove Erdogan, because he was about to change sides. He's about to go and negotiate with Putin.
Well, okay, let's look at the context.
That's what I think is the meat of this.
Context of all of this is that the Turks, as part of NATO, shot down that Russian plane, didn't they? A Russian jet. And literally just about 2 weeks ago now, there was a fulsome apology, apparently, from Erdogan saying, we're very sorry that happened. We won't make sure it won't happen again. And there's certainly some sort of rapprochement was going
there
on
is,
between
and also
Turkey
the other,
and Russia.
The other thing was reported in the Guardian, but hardly anywhere else in the Western media, they're also saying we're going to have to deal with Assad. Yeah, we've given up trying to overthrow him. Now, that's when Erdogan is a loose cannon, to put it mildly. And he's now come to the conclusion that everything he's been doing for the last few years is all wrong. It's about time to make peace with the Russians and make peace with Damascus. Now, at that point, the military intervene, although not successfully. Which then, of course, this is of great geopolitical importance here. Turkey is a very, very important country in terms of international politics.
I noticed at one point last Saturday, I think it was, I read a report saying that the Inkilik Air Base had been surrounded by Turkish
soldiers,
and all their electricity was cut off. So this is one of the main US air bases in NATO, cut off by its domestic individuals there, so there were no power either.
There were 50 US nuclear warheads on the airbase, and Erdogan was in a position to take them over and say, we're now a nuclear power, we've got 50 warheads. That's how crazy it all is.
Well, what about the mass arrests and the taking down civil liberties? Because one of the things he's been talking about, Martin, is actually reintroducing the death penalty retrospectively, if you could believe that.
Yep, because don't forget, it was
When you did it, it was okay, it was an imprisonable offence, but I'm going to change the law and say that when you did it, actually, now I can hang you.
Well, it's sending a signal, isn't it? Don't forget that the Turkish military have tried to overthrow the democratic government of Turkey and succeeded on many occasions in the past. In 1962, in the 1950s, in the 1990s, in 1980, they were the first country in the world to impose IMF structural adjustment when the social democratic government of East Turkey was kicked out by the military. And that military, that Turkish military, is armed and trained by NATO. That means their chaps are trained at Sandhurst. Many people in the street in Turkey, now listen to this, people listening to this show, they think that we, the British, were behind the coup. And you may say, well, we're not behind the coup. What's it got to do with us? I say, Turkey's part of NATO. We run NATO. The British and the Americans run NATO. Many people in Turkey are absolutely convinced that we were behind the coup. And we were definitely behind the coup in 1980 and the coup attempt in the 1990s. And eventually, of course, a lot of top generals in Turkey were sent to prison for life for carrying out false flag terrorist attacks. They were bombing things, shooting things, pretending to be left-wingers, pretending to be right-wingers, pretending to be Islamists, but in actual fact it was the MIT, the Turkish intelligence services. They've been caught red-handed by their own police force supplying weaponry to ISIS. All of these things are true, and Turkey is an integral part of NATO. So all the evil things that have been happening in Turkey inside the military and inside the intelligence structure, the deep state, Ergonican, that is the responsibility of the Americans and the British in particular. So we are held responsible. And when people in the rest in Britain say, well, why do they hate us? Well, what you say is, well, we've imposed military governments on them five times in the last 50 years and killed hundreds of thousands of their people. Would they hate us for that? I think I might if I was Turkish or Kurdish. What would you think, Tony?
What about the Israelis? Do you think they were involved as well?
They may have been involved, yep. Because if Erdogan was genuinely thinking of changing his tack and deciding he was going to cozy up to the Russians and give up on overthrowing Assad, lots of people in the West would have been very unhappy about that, and that includes within his own military.
And why has Erdogan been closing down newspapers, closing down political and election polling organisations, and you know, basically kicking journalists out of the country, and it's even imprisoning some that he doesn't agree with? Well, if he's got any real interest in having a modern democracy, he's a dictator.
Well, he's no more or less of a dictator than Mohamed Morsi in Egypt. And in actual fact, the Egyptian military government were very keen for this coup to succeed because they don't like Erdogan. Now, the fact of it is that Erdogan is an authoritarian populist. He has mass support. There is no doubt about it. And some people compare him to Putin. I think that's wrong. Erdogan is a much nastier piece of work than Putin. Putin has checks and balances. Erdogan has none. But don't forget that Turkey is a very fragile state because 20 million people, a substantial section of the population, are Kurdish, the people that live in the southeast of the country, and they don't want to be part of the state at all. And, of course, there's a real possibility here that the state could break up. And of course, we've been backing the Turkish military in their war against the people of Turkish Kurdistan over 20 or 30 years. Tens of thousands of people have been killed. Even in the last year, hundreds and hundreds of civilians have been killed in cold blood by the Turkish military. And that Turkish military is part of NATO. So those people on the receiving end, they blame us. They blame Britain. They blame the Americans. And when people say, oh, well, what have we ever done to hurt these people? Say, everything. You've done everything to hurt these people. I mean, they hit back at you. Can you cry?
I've seen a couple of articles pointing the fingers at Erdogan, saying, "Well, look, this is his Reichstag fire. Maybe he was involved in creating this because it's given him a fantastic excuse to arrest and jail all his political opponents."
I've seen that suggestion. I would suggest that's a bit.
I mean, the actual comparison is with the big bomb that blew off the side of the Parliament building. Last Friday night.
The Turkish military have always engaged in false flag operations because they're part of NATO, and they were even more enthusiastic about false flag operations than the Italians or the Belgians. Everybody in Turkey knows that the deep state, the Ergonican state, which was exposed when a car crashed, which had a top drug dealer and a top general in it, and was stuffed with weaponry and information in the 1990s. And in the past, the military have used false flag terrorism, including bombing things, shooting people, killing people, in order to try and prevent Erdogan's party, the Justice and Development Party, from coming to power. Now, the Justice and Development Party is a legitimate political force, but it's true in life in general. You can have legitimate political forces who represent ordinary people who behave in an authoritarian way, and especially, of course, when people feel threatened. Don't forget, hundreds of people were killed in this military coup. It wasn't a bloodless military coup. Lots of people lost their lives. The army killed people. That's bound to make people a bit angry. And I think what Erdogan is doing is he's using the occasion of the coup to try and obtain total control. But it's very interesting that the HDP, which is the Kurdish party in the parliament, which is very hostile to Erdogan, they're at daggers drawn, he's about to threaten to lock them all up and all the rest of it, they came out immediately in support of, not of him, but of Turkish democracy, as did the Iranians. And I believe the Syrians and the Russians also came out in support of Erdogan. And I do
well,
not.
So I heard
him.
John Kerry last Friday night saying that democracy must be upheld, etc.
Well, that's right. That's what everybody says. But then the cynics in the street in Turkey will say, "Well, the Americans say that. Oh, that's what the State Department."
Do you have any evidence that this was organised from the US airbase Interlik?
Yep, that's what Erdogan himself is saying. That's why they closed down. That's why they closed it down.
What about this Gulen movement in the US?
Well, he's very close to the CIA. He's based in the US. He owns loads of charter schools in the US. He's a multimillionaire. He's a multimillionaire, moderate Islamist businessman, supposedly moderate. But his people and Erdogan's people have been very involved in the creation of jihadist groups right across the Middle East, right across Central Asia, and even as far as Xinjiang.
It sounds like a bit like a Turkish version of bin Laden and his Wahhabism.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, the point is that Gladio, Sybil Edmonds, the former FBI translator, is Turkish, has just written a novel about Gladio. You've got to realise that the Turks, in particular, and the Turkish military have been intimately involved in false flag terrorism across them. I mean, they've been supply. The Russians have given chapter and verse to the UN about the Turkish military supplying weaponry and arms to Al Qaeda and ISIS in Syria.
Also,
and they are part of NATO.
Also,
it's not as if the British don't know about this. The British have been there helping them. And then people say, where did these jihadis come from? Well, ask MI6. They've been training them for years.
Also, it was quite interesting, at 10 o'clock on... they obviously had the article all ready to go on last Friday night. The BBC published an article called, with the headline, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Turkey's ruthless president. According to the Istanbul governor, the military coup camp has been suppressed. The commander of Istanbul's Third Corps reportedly issued a televised order for all troops to return to barracks. Now, this is a really scathing article published by the BBC, really just as the coup was being announced.
So, in other words, shock, horror, the BBC are being used as part of a coup attempt in Turkey. The Western powers were very quiet until it was clear that the coup had failed, and then they came out and condemned it. People who are the supporters of Erdogan, and not just the supporters of Erdogan, I'm quite sure that the HDP and Kurdish radical forces like the PKK will be very cynical about what's happened here. Because don't forget, this has happened in Turkey in the past.
There have been
military coups in Turkey, all organised from Washington and London. And people say, well, that's nothing to do with us. Yes, it is. It always was. It still is. And then you say, well, why are all these refugees coming? Because you started these wars. You said you wanted them, now you've got them.
Another indication the US were involved is the Federal Aviation Administration last Friday night and Saturday banned all Turkish airlines from flying to the US.
The way the Americans do coups is they have the State Department condemning the coup, meanwhile the CIA are actually running the coup. So that the State Department can have plausible deniability. Oh, well, it's just an internal matter in Turkey. We'll have to adapt to it. But nevertheless, they can still be behind it. I'm quite sure that the elements within the Turkish military who thought they could get away with the coup also thought that they would get a wink and a nod from the NATO powers. That includes Theresa May, Boris Johnson and others. Of course, it hasn't worked. And now there's a hell of a mess to clean up, isn't there?
Just to recap on last week's horrific attack in Nice, I noticed last night an article which is the French Interior Ministry ordering the mayor's office in Nice to destroy all CCTV images and pictures from the event.
Now, why would they want to do something like that if they wanted to get to the truth of the event? The fact is, folks, who listen to this show week in, week out, you will know that more often than not, terrorist events are being orchestrated by somebody's intelligence services. Virtually all of them. There are hardly any events which haven't got some intelligence fingerprint in them. And
I noticed, of course, that he was being followed by the FBI, that guy. I mean, he was the local French intelligence services and police had never come across him before, but the FBI were following him very closely.
Well, it now turns out that he's supposedly got accomplices and Rita...
Well, they've just arrested all of his friends and they've turned them into his accomplices.
Yeah, so they've turned them into his accomplices. But Rita Katz's
Search for International Terrorist Entities.
They were the ones that put up the so-called ISIS claim of this. Now, they, of course, are Mossad and CIA linked. That all of the... People find it hard to believe that the intelligence services in the Western world would carry out such an evil attack in order to create fear and tension and in order to bring in martial law and all the rest of it. Nobody in Turkey has any delusions that NATO is anything other than a full-on terrorist organisation. Nobody, whatever political side of the political spectrum they come from. People in the West are naive about what goes on. They simply are.
BCFM. Now, we're going to turn to have a look at the international economics and a little bit of history now, Martin, because we're going to hear from Yanis Varoufakis, who's the former Chancellor, effectively, or Finance Minister in Greece. And here he talks, this is a talk in the US, about the European Union. He looks a little bit into the origins of the European governments and how we got, which is one of the things that the mainstream media hardly ever do, why we got and how we got where we are today.
The British state, the American state, how were these states brought into being? It was the result of centuries, of decades of class conflict, of conflict between different vested interests. Initially, and that's what produced the Magna Carta in this country, it was the barons against the king. Then you had the merchants that came in with their own separate interests, fighting the other two sides. Then you had the proletariat. You had different parts of capital with its own vested interests, like financial capital, the banking sector versus industrial capital, manufacturing. And the state emerged as part of an evolutionary process for regulating these conflicts with sovereignty, with democratic processes, which became important because they were more efficient at regulating these conflicts. Now compare and contrast that kind of system of governance, state, with the European Union. How was the European Union created? It was created in the late 1940s, designed and effected in the early 1950s, 1950 onwards, as a cartel of heavy industry. The first name of the European Union was the European Community of Coal and Steel. So, the manufacturers, the heavy industries of coal and steel in Belgium, in Holland, in Germany, in eastern France and in northern Italy, became one cartel. And it happened under the stewardship of the United States of America and the new dealers who were running the show at the time. And it was a very important part of that global post-war design, which was a very interesting design, and I'm not criticizing it, I'm simply stating it as a fact. Now, the problem is that, you know, every cartel has its administration, like OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, has its own administration. That cartel had its administration and it was located in Brussels. So Brussels began not as the government of a state, but it began as the administration minding the interests of a cartel, the purpose of which was to regulate competition, to prevent effectively competition between those industrialists, and that cartel then became expanded.
So it's like a big mafia family controlling...
Yeah, so they co-opted the French farmers. It's called the Common Agricultural Policy. Yeah. Then they co-opted the bankers. Then they expanded geographically. But it still remained a technocracy in Brussels with deep contempt for democracy. Democracy was simply, for them, a process of elections that would validate their power to make decisions independently of the demos, or the demi, the plural of demos. Now, it is very important, at least from the perspective of those of us who are unfortunate enough to be living under the euro, to understand why the euro emerged. A cartel requires price stability. So OPEC is all about regulating the price of oil. The cartel of coal, steel, and all the other commodities that began to participate in that had to keep prices constant. That's the whole point of the raison d'etre of a cartel. Now, to keep prices constant when you have different countries, the exchange rates between those countries have to be maintained. But it was okay for the first 20 years because the Americans maintained those exchange rates at constant levels on behalf of the whole of the Western world. It was called the Bretton Woods system that was inaugurated in 1944. It was designed, it was inaugurated a bit later. John Maynard Keynes had played a role in designing it. His ideas were better than the ones that were used in the end, but that's another story. This system collapsed in 1971. And the Deutschmark value vis-a-vis the Italian lira, the French franc, started fluctuating. So the cartel that was the European Common Market was under pressure, and it was very close to collapse. They had to stabilize the exchange rate, so they started the process of fixing them. It didn't work. Britain escaped one of those attempts to fix the exchange rates when Norman Lamont got you out of the Eurozone, of the Maastricht Treaty. You remember, it was the instance that made George Soros a very rich man in the early 1990s. And then when that didn't work, they tried something much more drastic and radical, a common currency.
That's Yanis Varoufakis, not in the States, as I said, in error. It was obviously speaking in the UK there. Martin, what he's doing is he's laying out a sort of a little timeline, really, from pre-war, obviously, medieval Europe, right the way through to the cartels at the end of the Second World War, setting up the effectively heavy industries, controlling their own markets by sharing work out amongst themselves. And then he's saying effectively what they had to do through the European Union was to organise a kind of money cartel, and that's what the Euros become.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a pretty good summary of the basic history of what's happened. People, cartels are not necessarily bad. It's a question of, you know, but you've got to be clear about what's going on.
But there's no competition, which of course is important. You're not going to get innovation if you've got no competition.
That's not true. In actual fact, the way in which cartels compete, say for example in the car industry, which is a cartel, most industries are cartels, especially if you've got large scales of production, because you can't have lots of
producers.
They
squash the little people out,
don't they? Yes, but can I just finish? You squash the little people out because you can't produce cars on a small scale. It's just not feasible.
Actually, you can. There's a company called Bristol Cars, which is still making very expensive cars.
Not for the mass market,
cars.
Tony.
No.
The point is that the oil companies, the supermarkets, all function as cartels, or what is in the textbook called oligopolies. Now, that means that prices are fixed unless there's a price war. When you have price wars, they can turn into real wars. You know, this is how the real economy really works.
But there's no price wars in a cartel.
No, but the point
they just jack up the price.
Let me get to the point. It's not just about price competition, it's about non-price competition. What you do in Japan at the end of the Second World War, they decided, right, it's rational for us to have three firms in this industry. So you have three firms as opposed to four, and then you fix the prices, and then the competition between the firms is who can produce the best widget for that price. And in actual fact, that's how technological change is actually driven research and development investment by big companies.
Sounds like you're a fan of cartels.
I'm not a fan. I'm just pointing out that the idea that cartels are bad economics.
It's a stitch-up against the public.
It's not a stitch-up against the
public. Yes, it is.
If you're Adam Smith, it's a stitch-up against the public, but Adam Smith is a long time dead. Modern economies function on deals between big organisations. They've always functioned like that. It's a fantasy to believe otherwise.
So they can fix prices and that's fine.
Yeah, they fix, but yeah, no, not just for fix. But just think, unions try to fix prices in the labour market. Nobody's to be paid less than the union rate. Cartels are part...
So who's in the driving seat here? The cartels or the unions?
Well, what ultimately happens in countries like Germany is you've got strong unions, strong cartelised industry, which also has a long supply chain in the Mittelstand where the small guys get their piece of the pie. And they're not just thrown away like the Keiretsu system in Japan. The big companies subcontract to the small companies as long as they're loyal to the big companies and vice versa.
This is funnelling wealth all away from... away from ordinary people into the hands of big corporations who are then lobbying so they don't have to pay any tax.
No, the real problem is the autonomy now of the financial services sector, which battens on everybody else. In the past, in places like Germany and Japan, the leaders of the big companies were paid a lot less than they are now, and they were engineers. They were people who knew about making stuff. Now, the people who run the big companies are all lawyers, and they know about financial engineering, which is not about making stuff.
That's a difference.
And they, of course, don't like cartels. They like everybody coming to them to borrow money to compete. And there's an ideology.
The cartel is a complete destruction of any kind of idea of a capitalist system.
It is.
Because, I mean, you look at the oil companies, for example. They're making massive, massive profits. They're moving their... themselves around the world, but putting their companies into different countries, so they have to pay minimal amounts of tax, actually. And they're just fixing the markets. They also lie quite regularly about known oil reserves. So, these people are manipulating.
With that is you move on to the next stage, which is nationalisation. Cartelisation leads to nationalisation.
There isn't any proper regulation of these massive industries.
I don't want regulation, I want nationalisation.
And at the end of the day, the people who lose out are the people down in Port Talbot who haven't got a job, possibly in a few weeks' time.
But you're just peddling a free market philosophy fantasy.
It's not
in
a fantasy
world,
for those people who are about to lose their jobs.
In the real world, as Varoufakis pointed out in his little piece, all markets are regulated. It's Aglietta's regulation thing.
So is Britain not regulating the market?
No.
Is that why Port Talbot is closing?
What's happening now is instead of being regulated by the democratic government, it's being regulated by the financial services industry. They decide who lives and dies on the basis of their own bottom line.
That's no real regulation, is it?
No, it's not. Well, it is regulation, but it's regulation of the wrong kind.
Yes. Okay,
nobody operates in a deregulated market. A deregulated market means I can just put a gun to your head and take your money off you. All markets depend upon some kind of rules. The question is, what are those rules going to be and who's going to make them? I'm just making the economic
Martin,
case
how can you have
against free
market. What you're saying is regulation is regulation even when it's done by the same people that own the business.
Well,
it's not regulation.
No, all markets are regulated in the sense that there is no free competition. There never was. Somebody decides what the price is going to be. It's either a big producer or it's the government.
Yeah,
I would prefer the government, but it's the big producer if it isn't the government.
Martin,
it's certainly not
nobody is allowed into these markets anymore. What we're seeing is
even in the heyday of capitalism, British free market capitalism depended very much on the Royal Navy smashing their way into Beijing. That's what free
I'm saying
and
is
they say, what you need is more free market. That's our gunboat telling you to bring the free market in, and there's
no free market.
There never was in the 1840s,
stopping,
the 1940s.
You're stopping me even speaking. I mean, I should just fade you down, I suppose, but I'm too polite to do that. But it means that certainly in the post-war time, lots of people could start their own business and they could get into markets. It's almost impossible to do that nowadays.
That's not entirely true, as we've seen in this startup, that there's far too many people starting up what a worthless industry.
Have you seen the number of empty shops, for example?
Yes, I know. Yes, but
the only shops that can survive are these chains.
I'm getting exasperated with you because I'm trying to broaden your understanding of how economies work, and you just keep coming back to this fantasy.
It's not a fantasy. This is about people
being
able to have their own.
Never existed. It didn't exist in 19th century Britain, and it doesn't exist today. All markets are rigged. All markets, without fail.
You've said that about 20 times now, and I'm not saying that they are not. All I'm saying is that what you're seeing is all of the power concentrated in fewer and fewer hands.
Indeed.
And there's far and far, far, far less businesses out there that are viable, that are small businesses, family business, etc. It's all being run by these international cartels and chains
now. One of the things you could do if you had more government intervention is you could have a policy of encouraging small businesses. So, for example, you could say that we want to protect small farmers.
That's not happening under the cartel system anyway. We've got to move on.
Yeah.
Because we've got a piece now from
political power
from Martin Wolf, who's one of the main Financial Times is chief political correspondent at the financial correspondent at the Financial Times. Martin Wolf was on BBC yesterday talking about how low can rates go, and this is a great example of the Bilderberg speaking because it's a good idea to track what the people who are in the Bilderberg conference we were over in Dresden are saying as they come out. So let's have a listen to an extract from that now.
Triti Vadera of Santander Bank.
I often think of central bankers as like Atlas carrying the burden of the world on their shoulders on their own. I know why, because it's easier, because they don't operate in the full glare of politics and the public eye. They're accountable to a greater or lesser extent, depending on which country. But fiscal stimulus or structural reforms do have to accompany monetary policy, and they haven't done that in a balanced way in every country. Mario Draghi said in 2012 that monetary policy was like a bridge. It has to go somewhere, and we've been building this bridge for a long time, and I'm beginning to worry that it's a bridge to nowhere.
The path we are on seems to be taking us to some strange places in which the very meaning of money comes into question.
There's something special about money, and one of the special features is that it has a known value. £1 is £1 is £1, and that's as much a psychological thing for the person in the street as it is a financial thing. As soon as you begin to question the notion that a pound is a pound, perhaps a pound today is 99p tomorrow, I think that could, in principle, have quite a big psychological impact.
Andy Haldane is the chief economist of the Bank of England. He has postulated the idea of a cashless society, currency distributed through a digital wallet. It's a radical and controversial idea, but it could serve a purpose. Electronic cash could make using the lever of interest rates more effective, especially if those rates drop below zero, since the value of the money in your digital wallet could go up or down. And, as Andy Haldane explains, even though this might be a proposal for the distant future, the technology to make this possible is with us today.
On the face of it, when you talk about digital money, people think you're crazy. But truth be told, almost all money is digital already. Almost all money issued by commercial banks is digital. And actually, almost all money issued by central banks is digital too. What we're talking about is the little bit that's left as it's currently physical cash. Am I proposing that should be scrapped and abolished? Absolutely, I am not. It's not for any public official to be prescribing those things. But do I think over time it's possible we might wish to contemplate a form of cash that is digitized? That strikes me as a likely direction of travel.
Charles Goodhart and Treaty Vadera agree that big dangers lie ahead. Monetary policy is not exhausted. It is possible to lower interest rates further into negative territory. But the effects on the financial system might be extremely damaging. Beyond a certain point, the drive into negative territory might make it necessary to curb access to cash. So-called helicopter money would work, but the temptation for politicians to abuse this possibility might prove too great. The fact that we are even considering such possibilities 9 years after the global financial crisis began shows how far we are from a return to normality. It also shows how dependent we have become on central banks as the only game in town. The two phenomena are related. We are dependent on central banks because we have not taken other measures. And we have not taken other measures because policymakers are happy to leave everything to the central banks. If events like Brexit generate recessions, central banks will start from a weak position with all conventional room for manoeuvre gone. They will be forced to embark on still more experiments. And we are the guinea pigs. This is an unpredictable, uncomfortable, and unprecedented condition for our economies, with profoundly worrying political implications. It seems set to last.
Well, that's Martin Wolf there from the Financial Times, and also from the Dresden Bilderberg meeting earlier this year. Martin, he seems to be saying, pointing the finger as almost a sort of a representative of the private, giant private banks, pointing the finger at the central bank, saying, you've messed up here.
Well, the problem is that they're pushing on a string. They're relying entirely on monetary policy. What should have happened in 2008 is that governments all over the world should have got a grip and started to spend their own money on infrastructure, on education, on training. But instead, they gave it to the central banks to keep goosing up the private banks in the hope that capitalism would somehow self-correct. It hasn't happened.
The other point that he's making is the interest rates going down and down also. I mean, he's effectively saying that digital money is the future, cash is dead.
Well, they need to do that because, of course, nobody's going to keep their money in the bank if there's a negative interest rate. That means that the money in the bank gets smaller day by day, whereas cash won't do that, especially in a deflationary situation. So the only way they can have negative interest rates is by getting rid of cash.
So you're saying that people are trying to would be tempted to just keep money under the mattress?
Absolutely. So you take that option away from them, saying that money isn't worth anything, you've got to have a credit card.
Interesting. Well, also, of course, the other thing with digital money is you can track everything, follow everything that everyone does. And also, if you fancy it, you can click your fingers and switch them off.
That's right. That's right. It gives more power to the central authorities controlling the system.
interesting to see what these bankers are up to. Anyway, we're going to move on now to look at our five great crime families that run the Western world. This is something Martin pointed out to me a few weeks ago, but I think there's definitely only a ring of truth to it. Top of the list is the Rothschilds family, richest family in the world. Wealth estimated, although they don't appear on the rich list, only an advert for their wine appears on the rich list of the Sunday Times. Wealth is estimated between $100 and $500 trillion in assets. A hub of global finance since in the 1760s, Mayor Amschel Rothschild placed his five sons in the world's five financial centres. In the 1800s, they funded monarchies, governments and armies on both sides during the Napoleonic Wars, brokers and councillors of the kings of Europe and Republican chiefs in America. Paul Warburg, he worked for the Rothschilds. He created the Federal Reserve Bank through the Federal Reserve Act in 1913 in the US. Today, the Rothschilds are said to have a controlling interest in the US Federal Reserve. Now, Martin, the main point here is that these people are able to hide their wealth and keep their names off of the rich list.
Well, that's the real power brokers don't want to be known. And most of the real string pullers at Bilderberg are people haven't heard of.
Then there's the Rockefeller family. John D. Rockefeller founded Standard Oil Company back in 1870. It made him the richest individual in history at the time, with a net worth of $400 billion. Theodore Roosevelt warned Rockefeller interests are creating an invisible government. The Rockefeller Foundation funded founding of the United Nations headquarters and the Bilderberg conferences, controlling shares they have in the Chase Manhattan Bank, Exxon Mobil, Chevron and BP, the Rockefellers.
Well, there you go. It's not just the Rothschilds then. There are others.
Interesting way they've come from oil into banking, because you can make money much more easily by pressing a computer button and making up trillions of dollars at the punch of a button.
Well, what we've seen in recent years is the financial services sector becoming the dominant fraction of capital. Industrial capital is very much on the back foot.
Then number three is the Morgan family. In 1893, John Pierpont Morgan and the Rothschilds gave the US Treasury 3.5 million ounces of gold during the first financial panic in 1893. They gained control of the US gold supply and created the largest US corporations, such as General Electric, AT&T and US Steel. There's an allegation that the Morgan family pressurized the White House into World War One to protect loans which had been made to Russia and France, which was a fear of they were going to default on them. J.P. Morgan Jr. collected $5 million straight commission for helping the U.S. Treasury out with a $500 million World War One loan. So that's just for the just the commission, $5 million. In World War Two, it's rumoured Morgan dealings with the Japanese Iwaski and Dan clans, who owned Mitsubishi and Mitsui, encouraged the 1941 Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor to guarantee enormous war material contracts to both. Morgan has the world's largest private gold vault in New York.
Yep, these people have been behind the scenes all the time.
Yes, and also involved in the... I think we were hearing earlier about somebody from the Labour cabinet who was working for J.P. Morgan. Also, the DuPont family, number four. In 1802, Eleuthère Irénée DuPont, de Nemours, established a gunpowder mill in Delaware, helped negotiate the Louisiana Purchase in 1803. By 1914, the DuPont Company was selling 40% of the world's explosives. In 1944, it was producing plutonium for the Manhattan Project, lobbied for prohibition of hemp farming and marijuana use in order to protect their nylon manufacturing business. Today, the DuPont Corporation is the second largest producer of GMO seeds in the world. It funds its own doomsday seed vault so its product can replant the earth if there's ever a global disaster.
Yeah, well, they are another one of the five big families, but they come from different sources, these different groups, but of course they cooperate together as well.
Then the Bush family, most notorious, I suppose, most recently, 1895, Prescott Sheldon Bush was born, went to Yale University, to the Skull and Bone Society, which is notorious too, at Yale University, 322, Anthony Sutton's written a lot about that. 1933, Prescott led a failed coup attempt against Franklin Roosevelt to install a fascist dictatorship in the US. It was funded by the DuPonts, the Rockefellers and the Morgans. The business plot was covered up,
Prescott Bush rose to be the director of Union Banking Corporation and prosecuted twice for trading with the enemy in World War II. He was suspected of hiding Nazi gold. The son of George H.W. and grandson George W. both became president of the US, and they both initiated wars with Iraq that profited companies with the Bush family ties, such as Halliburton and Kellogg Brown Root. Today, it's the most powerful family in America, with fortunes in banking, and Jeb ran for the Republican nomination.
Yeah, well, they are more political in a sense, because they've got people who actually stand for public office, etc. But don't forget that these four, five families actually cooperate with each other. The Bush family, Jeff Prescott Bush, led the coup attempt against Roosevelt, but he didn't do it on his own. He had plenty of people from within the other five families that were interested in its success.
Well, I'm enjoying looking into some of this political context, so we'll do the same again next week, I think, a little bit deeper into the rabbit hole by looking at a guy, or having an interview with Fritz Springmeier, who's done a book called The Bloodlines of the Illuminati, which goes into even deeper into history. But to wind up this week, on Tuesday evening, I was up at Menwith Hill RAF base, which is the NSA's headquarters. Now, Martin, this has been extremely controversial since the revelations of Edward Snowden, effectively the Americans using this base to spy on pretty much everything we do here in Britain.
Well, I think they used it more back in the days of old technology to bug old-style landlines. But yes,
if you look at some of these flags, some of the things we're objecting to are things like the illegal use of drones, you know, which is obviously there's been a lot in the press about, and so in a way it's publicising the fact that we're challenging those things to do with communications, you know, that you can wage warfare at a distance and the problems of that, really.
We also have links with Guantanamo, London Guantanamo campaign, so quite often we do vigils and Father Guantanamo, the closure of Guantanamo, so we did one last week, didn't we? Because it was President Obama's promise that he would close Guantanamo down. 2 weeks ago he had 200 days to fulfil his promise. Last week, last Tuesday, it was 191 days. So we came up and we dressed up in our Guantanamo outfits. We also have links with Jeju Island, South Korea.
Yes, I think there's a sense of showing solidarity with movements opposing US bases in other parts of the world, which are obviously a lot better supported than this, you know, demonstration here, like in Ramstein or Okinawa or, you know, these places, in solidarity with this as well, I think.
And we do get guest speakers. You were saying about Bruce Gagnon. He was here.
The one explaining about the missile defence to me, that, you know, in the war games that they play, they practice a first strike scenario. And this had been published in some erudite journal. They obviously thought nobody would actually read this, that this was what was going on. But it wasn't just missile defence, in inverted commas, it's also could be an offensive weapon.
I think while ever they're here, forcing themselves around the world, because that in effect that's what they are doing, and they are being opposed everywhere for this. They've not got one in Sweden yet, but we do know that they're using part of the north of Sweden to do the practicing with the aircraft, how to kill people better, I suppose, how to bomb people. We know that that happens.
Well, that's a bit naughty, isn't it? Because Sweden's not supposed to be in NATO.
Absolutely. Well, you talk to some of our lovely colleagues over in Sweden, they will tell you, and actually they kind of joke about it, that it's becoming like another state of America. So there are many, many people around the world that oppose what's happening and how they're enforcing their bases there.
It's almost like a vicious circle. We've created a situation where Russia feels under threat, encircled by US bases, NATO bases, and the Russians have given away a lot in the past, haven't they? Previous presidents have given away a lot, it seems, to the US, to me. Yeah.
Well, they've certainly given away a lot of the former Soviet Union. Many of those countries are now NATO countries.
Exactly. And the verbal agreement wasn't it, that NATO would not be expanded.
That was Sarah Swift there, and Bridget Mary Oates outside Menwith Hill Base up in Yorkshire speaking to me on Tuesday evening. You can hear the full interview next Tuesday at noon here on BCFM on the Dialect Show. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Up next, there's a gap in the schedule. Mohamed Makawi's off in Sudan. thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show's links and its archives. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car if you want. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.